This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
Many, many developments in technology again. This week, a $50 tablet came out.
$50?
A $50
tablet. Is it worth anything?
Well, I'll give you the details on it.
Oh, yeah, I know. This is called a tease, right?
I'll give you the details on it. The Large Hadron Collider now has released an app for the Android, so you can track what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, get this. They specifically did not make the app for the iPhone, because these are more techie guys, and they only like the Android. Talk about that.
Oh, my God.
The Nobel Prize has been awarded for the two gentlemen who discovered the expanding universe.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's expanding, actually, at an accelerating rate. And I'll talk a little bit about what that means and how it relates to Einstein's general theory of relativity. Since it's physics, I have to just stick it in here somewhere in the show.
Of course you do, yes.
And, of course, BlackBerry finally got their email service up. They had a big announcement Thursday morning.
I knew you were going to talk about that.
BlackBerry, you know, has a problem. They're losing market share to the Android and to the iPhone. And this particular outage was something they did not need.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's actually what they were saying. We are premier at business email. And now if they're not premier there and they don't have a good smartphone, they're really coming up with an empty bag.
And this happens like 2 days or so around the time the latest iPhone gets issued.
Yes.
It's not the timing is pretty bad.
No, that's right. This week, we had another untimely death. Dennis Ritchie, who I'm going to feature in the Profiles in IT. I featured him earlier. He actually was the developer of the C language and co-developer of Unix. Many people believe that if it weren't for Dennis Ritchie, there would not be a Steve Jobs. He is the guy who standardized the technology upon which Apple was built. And so, you know, it's so I thought I would have some linkage between the two gentlemen and talk about what Dennis Ritchie did in his life and what he contributed. And, of course, it was a very heavy, heavy mailbag.
Of course
mailbag.
It was. It always is.
Now, it is time for...
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Big Voice. Dear, we have an email from John. Dear Tech Talk, I've got Windows Vista. I've got a 320 gigabyte hard drive that's around 3 months old. And I'm really into defrag. I've got two defragmentation utilities, and I'm thinking of purchasing one. I don't use Windows defragger at all. I'll explain what a defragger is in a minute.
I know what that is.
I know you do, but I'm just going to give a slight sidebar tutorial. One of the programs takes about 45 minutes to complete its business, and the other one takes only 10 minutes. Why is there such a big difference? What's going on here? Thanks, John. Well, let's talk about defragmentation. When you store files on a hard drive, frequently they get placed in different locations on the hard drive, so it's actually split up. The file is split up and stored in several discontinuous locations on the hard drive. So the file is fragmented on the hard drive. Now, what happens that operationally then? If you want to recall that file, you've got to look up fragment one and then look up location of fragment two, look up location of fragment three, and it's a little bit slower. So people like to take all the fragmented files and defragment them. In other words, make them continuous, stored in a continuous section of hard drive, and that's called defragging.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way that hard drives work, let me explain how hard drives store and then store files, and I can get into what the defrag does. They always, what they call, they store to the high water mark. So if you if you have a lot of files stored on your hard drive, all files will be stored up to a certain point. Then beyond that point, there are no files. And so the separation between files and no files is the high water point. And whenever you store a new file, it always puts it in the high water, above the high water point. So it's got enough room, so no matter how big the file is, it can just be stored continuously. The problem is when the hard drive gets almost filled, and there's not enough room in the high water mark area above the last file to store the entire file, then it has to start sticking it around and pushing it all, put a little bit here, put a little bit, because there might be gaps between the files that were stored previously, mm-hmm. gaps caused by file deletions usually. And so that's when you get the defragmentation problem. So you, if your hard drive is only partially filled, you don't really have too much of a fragmentation issue. So what normally happens when you when you do a simple defragmentation, you go through and your defrag program will just take and consolidate all of the files to make them continuous. Now, some programs decide they want to take and rewrite the files and pack them better. So they start moving files around, which means they might move one file above the high water mark so another file will fit in, and they're constantly moving files back and forth. So this repacking of the files is after defragmentation makes the hard drive operate a little bit quicker because all the files are close together, but it is slow as Moses. So probably the program which is running 45 minutes is actually optimizing your hard drive and actually packing them together. Now, whenever I do a defrag, Windows 7, by the way, does defrag automatically. They've got Windows Defragger, and the default configuration, it defrags your hard drive once a week or so automatically. You don't even have to pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. But what I always do, whenever I install a new piece of software, you know, and you're really copying a lot of files on there, since those executables are not going to be moved again, I like those to be in an optimized location. So after I do a big hardware install or I do a big Windows update or something, I'll go in and do a defrag. And I'll ask for an optimized defrag where it puts the files that are used very frequently, all your operating system files, your executables, it puts them down at the beginning of the hard drive so they can be reached quicker. Now that kind of optimized defrag takes a lot longer, but after a big install, I do it. And normally I don't mess around with it very much. When defrag first came out, I liked to play with it a lot. But actually, hard drives now have gotten so fast that you don't really have to defrag a lot all the time. We got an email. Thanks. That was a great email, John. We have an email from Allison. Dear Tech Talk, I understand that Congress is asking the Federal Communications Commission, called the FCC, to look into what and to look into sites that use super cookies.
Ooh.
Without the computer user's permission or even knowledge. What are super cookies, and how can I protect my computer against them? Thanks, Allison. Well, super cookies, and I'll explain what that is, were invented by website owners, or more likely advertising networks, to accumulate data about what sites you're visiting. And there are cookies that even if you go to your browser cache and disable cookies or you delete all cookies, they seem to be persistent and they come back. So they're super cookies. Well, why do people do that? They're not actually interested in you personally. It's not really a privacy issue so much, but they want to deliver targeted ads. So for instance, if you go to say a car vendor, you go to say the Lexus website. Okay, they put a cookie on your site that says, hey, this guy looked at this ES350 uh-huh. car. And so that is, so they have stored in the data, and they put a user ID, a tracking number, in the cookie. And then they store that tracking number in their central databases, and they say, user XXX likes the Lexus 350. So then what happens, every time you go to another website that's serviced by that same advertising network, they deliver an ad about the Lexus 350. So it seems like, as far as you're concerned, it's everywhere.
Right.
And so they love to have this targeted delivery of ads based on your behavior. And that's what the super cookies are used for. I don't know really that it's a huge privacy issue because they don't directly relate your identity with it. They just put a tracking number on it. Now, if you go on, though, and buy something and put in all your information, I suppose they do have enough data. Once you make a purchase or do something where you reveal all your personal data, that they could relate that tracking number to your personal data. But that's really not the purpose of it. Now let's talk about how these cookies work. Cookies actually were invented as part of the internet protocol, HTTP protocol, that web browsers use. And they originally set up for not advertising purposes, but to make it a more convenient experience for the user. So like if you go to a website and you configure the website, you have a whole lot of preferences, you could actually, with a cookie, they could store all those preferences in a cookie, so the next time you go to the website, all your preferences are set up. You don't have to go back and reconfigure it. The cookie could also remember your username. Not your password, but your username, so you don't have to type in your username again. And so cookies were meant to make it easier for individuals that were using the internet to go back and reuse a website. And then the advertisers got it. They said, "Hey, this cookie's a great thing. It's got persistent data. Why don't we take and we'll just store data on there? And then if it goes to another website, we'll pull the cookie up and see what's going on." So that's a third party use of the cookie, where the cookie is used not by the website that put it on there. It's used by another website. Now, that's really not what the user intended. So you can actually block cookies that are available to third-party websites if you want. And so then they started using cookies like that. And then people got wise, and they blocked cookies. And then you can go to your browser under security, and you can actually clear the cookie cache. And advertisers didn't like that. So then they decided, why don't we store it in some place other than the cookie cache of the web browser? So then they came up with, there are a number of ways that they can store information on your hard drive. I'll give a couple of them. The Flash player also has something like a cookie. And that was really designed for the same purpose. You go in and you want to play a Flash movie or something, it can remember your preferences. And so the Flash player has its own special cookie cache. So they started storing cookie information in the Flash player. They were called Flash cookies. So when you clear the cookies out of your browser, the Flash cookies aren't cleared. You've actually got to go to the Flash player in order to clear those cookies. And most people didn't even know where the Flash player was. So those ended up being persistent. Then they came up with even another technique called pixel manipulation. Because it turns out that every time when you're surfing the web, in order to speed things up, there's a cache that stores images and data from those. So you go to a website, the images on that website are stored in the cache. So the next time you go to the website, you pull the images out of your own computer's hard drive instead of off the internet, and it comes up faster. So you actually have quite a bit of cache stored. So what these websites will do, they'll take and they'll make a dedicated little image that they display just for you. But before they provide that image that your browser is going to display, they change a few pixels in it, which actually have your user ID. And then the next time somebody else goes to the website, they create another dedicated picture with that user ID. So now the persistent information is stored in this picture. It's not even a cookie anymore. And there's a little Java program or JavaScript program that can actually analyze the picture, can pull out those few pixels, and they can get the ID. So those would be that would be another type of persistent information that could be stored on your data, now on your hard drive. So what a super cookie is, it's a cookie that just doesn't go away. So suppose a website is using all three of these methods. They're using the HTTP cookie, they're using the Flash cookie, they're using the pixel manipulation cookie, and they use all of them. And then you go in and you delete the Flash cookie. Well, the next time you go back to the website, or the next time you go out somewhere that this advertiser network uses, they notice that two of the cookies are there, but the third cookie's gone. So they simply replicate the third cookie that you deleted. So you end up seeing that you might delete a cookie from your browser, and it shows right back up again. Mm-hmm. So it seems like it's a super cookie. So it's going to be hard to get rid of them all, but at least it's not a huge privacy or security issue for you, more at least at this point. But great question. Sorry, yes. Sorry it took so long to explain it, but it's kind of complicated.
It is. Exactly. Yeah. Well, you're listening to Tech Talk. It's Saturday morning, and we are here to deal with your tech issues and questions, and we've got profiles in IT coming up, so stay with us. You're listening to Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, 1035 FM HD2, and we'll be right back right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University.
Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to be featuring Dennis McAllister Ritchie. Dennis Ritchie was the creator of the C programming language and co-developer of the Unix operating system. He was instrumental in the development of programming languages and had an enormous impact on the internet and all operating systems that followed his pioneering work in programming languages. Dennis McAllister Ritchie was born September 9th, 1941, in Brocksville, New York. His father, Alistair Ritchie, was a longtime Bell Lab scientist and co-author of the book, The Design of Switching Circuits on Switching Circuit Theory. Ritchie received a Bachelor of Science in Physics in 1963.
I like the pause.
And a Ph.D. In 1968, both from Harvard. It was at Harvard that Ritchie first encountered a computer when he attended a lecture on the UNIVAC 1, and he was hooked. After getting his bachelor's degree, he went to work at MIT, which is, you know, just down the street there, where they were making their first movements and their first efforts in computer science away from the mainframe to the smaller, cheaper computers that were being, say, manufactured by Sun. In 1967, he moved to Bell Labs, which they're in New Jersey. Bell Labs was the home of the Multics project. Now, Multics project was an operating system that would replace batch processing with interactivity. See, I mean, when I did my PhD dissertation, I typed in everything in cards, and I would submit a batch of cards to the computer operator.
Uh-huh.
He'd put the cards in the card reader, and he'd run my program as a batch. And then I normally, since I was low priority, I would have to go in at the midnight shift, because at midnight, from midnight to 3 a.m., I was number one priority.
Uh-huh.
So I'd go in from midnight to 3 so I could be number one. And I was number one priority. I'd get my batch running there every night. That was, and then I started being able to log on and actually run the batch from the dumb terminal, and that was more interactive. So they were working on the technology that was going to allow that transition to occur. That was the Multics project.
Mm-hmm.
And this Multics lab was also home to Ken Thompson, who became one of Ritchie's primary collaborators. Now, Thompson and Ritchie wanted to get really one of these super deluxe computers, smaller non-mainframe computers. They wanted a DEC PDP-11. So they wanted to really, you know, to write operating systems for it. But the problem is there was really no line item for like writing operating systems. As you know, Bell Labs is sort of in, you know, in the business of the telephone switch business. So they got an idea. They went to their boss. They said, look, if you get us a DEC PDP-11, we will write a word processing program for the patent department. So they got the PDP-11, DEC PDP-11, so they could develop a word processor for the patent department. Okay, but before they could do that, they had to write an operating system. So they continued the work on the Multics that had been discontinued because it didn't appear to fit into the mission of Bell, mm-hmm. Bell Labs. So they continued as sort of a skunk works project, which they were working on themselves, as they were like secretly working on the word processor program. And they actually created the Unix operating system there, and it was the successor to Multics. Now, this was a very, very successful operating system. It spread within Bell Labs very quickly, and it was announced to the world in 1973, Unix. In the beginning, their only users in this multi-user system were three admins in the patent office who were actually entering in. Patents using the word processor. Now, the mid-70s was a period of really great experimentation and variation in computer design. Everybody was trying to come up with a smaller computer. You had DEC, then you had Sun. You had a lot of manufacturers coming up with all kinds of different computers trying to capture this new non-mainframe market. And the problem was, every single computer require. If you'd write a program for one computer and want to put it on another computer, it was like a huge deal. There was no portability. You would actually have to go back and write it, go down to the very basics, and you know, talk to that new piece of hardware. There was no high level language that you could port around, and so it was very difficult for computer programmers. Now, for hardware guys, that was fine. They didn't care. But if you wanted to empower the computer programmer, you needed something which was better than that. And so Dennis Ritchie, in order to solve that problem, designed the computer language C. And the C computer language was designed so that it would be quickly and easily moved between different hardware configurations. So you could put a C compiler on equipment A and a C compiler on equipment B, and you could take the same computer program, and if you programmed according to the rules of C, it would just port over without being rewritten. I mean, that was, at that time, extremely powerful for application developers. I mean, you could see you write one application, and all of a sudden it applies across the board. Then Thompson and Ritchie went back and rewrote the entire Unix operating system in C. Now, what that meant was that C was now that Unix was also portable between different systems. So now we had an operating system that was portable across multiple pieces of hardware, and this was actually transformational in the computer business. The Unix C revolution was enhanced when Ritchie collaborated with Brian Kernahan, and they wrote the C programming language. It was a thin book that was published in 1978, which was a concise definition of C and an introduction to the style and techniques of programming that Dennis Ritchie had perfected. And that made C really the de facto language in all schools was being taught. Now, it also turned out there was another thing that was very significant. Because there were legal antitrust restrictions on Bell Labs, they were in the telecom business, and because of antitrust law, they were not allowed to be in the computer business. So there was no way that they could sell this operating system. They were barred from being in the computer business, even though they had a lot of computer research going on. Mm-hmm. So that meant that Unix and C became essentially an open source system that Bell Labs could not benefit from financially. And that made a huge impact. And so you see what happened was that this Unix operating system in C, it was, you know, brought into the universities. It was open source. And pretty soon all the universities were running Unix machines. And the Unix API application programming interface was used for creating the protocol stacks for the Internet. The Internet was also open source, and so it was behind, and right at the time of this huge viral explosion of the Internet, Unix and C's direct, and what they call direct descendants include Linux, they include the Android, they include the Macintosh operating system, the iOS, which is the operating system on the iPhone, it includes JavaScript, and includes C++. Many people this week after Dennis Ritchie died, many people have said there would have been no Steve Jobs without a Dennis Ritchie, because the entire operating system that Macintosh really went with were really based on the Unix C combination. Dennis Ritchie really transformed so his code and his approach to writing code is sort of baked in operating systems and applications throughout the IT industry. Now, Richie had a lifestyle that you'd expect from an early guru of IT. He had long hair. He had a beard. He'd work late in hours at night. He'd stay up to like 2, 3 at night working, and then he would drag into work about noon. and he was just like consumed with his work. He was sort of like a dot-com guy. He was just like working full-time. He'd drag in there. His office was always a mess. He was really the sort of not really management type, although he was so influential in the operating systems. Ultimately, they did put him in a management position. He ended up being head of the Lucent Technology System Software Research Department. And they did say that occasionally they would see him there at work in the mornings if there was a management meeting. But I don't really think...
He wasn't a morning guy.
He was not. He was not a morning guy. Richie and Thompson received many industry awards, the biggest of which the ACM Turing Prize in 1983, and in 1998, the U.S. National Medal of Technology. This week, Dennis Richie was found dead on October 12, 2011, at age 70 at his home in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey. He suffered from prostate cancer and heart disease. So this was a sad week. And you start reading the testimony toward Dennis Richie. He was as influential in the development of many of our handheld devices and computer operating systems as Steve Jobs. It's just that he's not really that well known.
Right.
So he would be the technologist, and I would say Steve Jobs is the molder of the technology in a view of the consumer. So many people said, well, Steve died last week and he needed a Unix programmer up there in heaven with him.
So that's
the kind of stuff that they were saying this week on the in all the blogs. So we'll miss Dennis McAllister Richie.
Hope you were paying attention to Profiles in IT, because your chance to win a prize based on the knowledge is coming up. We're going to play the pop quiz next here on Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, 1035 FM HD2. Stand by. We will be right back.
Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor, 5 of the 30 occupations projected to grow the fastest by 2016 are IT-related, led by network and data communications analysts, software engineers, and systems analysts. 70% of business technology professionals surveyed by Information Week say there is a shortage of IT talent in the U.S. today. However, if you have previous military or management experience, there are tremendous opportunities for you in the IT field if you retrain. Stratford University's bachelor's degree in information technology prepares you to analyze, design, implement, administer, and secure computer networks and information systems. Master's degrees are also offered in information systems and software engineering. Day and evening classes are offered so you can continue in your current field. Call Stratford University at 800-444-0804 or visit online at stratford.edu. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, Tyson's Corner in Woodbridge.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
That's you.
Yes, welcome to the Classroom of the Airways, otherwise known as a radio show.
Wait a minute. Now you're freaking me out.
I know. So, here's the thing. If you attend class, you've got to pay attention.
Yes.
And your teacher expects you to be able to take a test.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to have a pop quiz today covering some of the material that we covered up to this point. And if you get the correct answer to this pop quiz, you will get 2 tickets to fine dining at either the Escoffier Dining Room or the Karim Dining Room at Stratford University, run by the Stratford University Culinary Arts Department.
That's right, because this is, you know, this is showbiz.
This is showbiz,
and we're adults here, so there has to be more at stake than just an A, B, or C.
Yeah, we're getting very close to opening the dining room in Richmond, so pretty soon we'll have a dining room in Richmond, and we'll also have a dining room open up very shortly in Newport News, Virginia.
Wow.
We've got that campus under construction. So anyway, earlier in the show I was talking about Dennis McAllister Ritchie, of course, was the creator of the C programming language and co-developer of the Unix operating system. When he went to Bell Labs, he and his compatriot were working on an operating system by a particular name. That particular project was canceled, and out of the ashes of that canceled project, they created Unix. What was the name of the canceled project that immediately preceded the development of Unix there at Bell Laboratories?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you get the correct answer to this, you'll get two tickets to fine dining. And, of course, you can reach us on the Internet by using Skype and going to Tech Talk Radio 1 and simply making a phone call to that account, and that will be forwarded to the studio. And there are more conventional ways to reach us,
yes,
too.
Yes, there are. For those of us humans who have simply a cell phone or a landline, you need to pick up the phone and call the following 10 digits in this order. 1-877-936-9333. 1-877-936-9333. 1-877-936-9333.
Well, Microsoft finally completed the purchase of Skype for $8.5 billion.
Wow.
I don't know if this was a good deal, but,
yeah,
you
because
know.
Skype's not making any money, are they?
No, not really. Well, Microsoft's hoping to integrate into some of their products. Now, the new Skype CEO, Tony Bates, he's the current Skype CEO, will continue to be, of course, work at Microsoft, and he will report directly to Steve Ballmer. And he will be named president of the Skype division of Microsoft. So they're not going to just break Skype up. They're going to kind of leave it as a standalone entity within Microsoft. Now, many of the Skype employees, no matter where they work, are going to still stay on board in the offices wherever they happen to be. They've got offices in Estonia, in Czechoslovakia, in Russia, in Sweden, in the UK, in Luxembourg, in Japan, in Singapore, Hong Kong, and the US. So somehow Microsoft is going to manage that far-flung group of developers and tried to integrate Skype into their system. In the official Microsoft blog, Bates described it as the marriage of two disruptive, innovative, software-oriented companies. Okay, he's committed to the ubiquity of Skype experience. He wants communication across every device and every platform, and that will remain his primary focus. So clearly they're going to integrate Skype into all of the Microsoft products. So we'll see how that develops. I'm skeptical that it's worth $8.5 billion, but I wish them the best.
Okay, we have got a contestant on the phone. Let us go to line number two. This would be Steve in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
Good. Staying out of the marathon traffic up there?
Yes, there is in downtown.
That's good. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Earlier in the show, I talked about Dennis Ritchie, and, of course, the developer of the C programming language and co-developer of Unix. What was the name of the project that he and Thompson worked on just before they developed the Unix operating system?
Yes, it was the Multics project.
That is correct.
That is correct. Steve, you're the winner.
Steve, that is very good.
Doc, tell him what he's won.
You'll win two tickets to fine dining at the Escoffier Dining Room or the Karem Dining Room, and that was an excellent job.
Yep. Steve, have you been listening to the show for long?
Yes, I've listened on and off for several years.
Very, very good. We thank you very much. We appreciate you listening. Stand on by on the phone. Andrew will take your information here, and we'll get those tickets right off to you. Doc, something
yes.
we need to promote.
Oh, yeah.
Facebook.
Facebook. I'm actually sitting here looking at Facebook, and you can go to the Facebook page. It's facebook.com/techtalkonline, and you'll be able, and just right on the wall, and I'll be monitoring it while we are on the air.
Very good.
I don't see anybody who has made a comment yet, but I'm checking.
Okay. He's always checking, folks.
Yes.
This is Tech Talk. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. Stand by. More Tech Talk after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the Internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost.
Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University.
Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tysons Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology, and the Nobel Prize for Physics was awarded to the two gentlemen that discovered the fact that the universe is expanding at an accelerated rate.
Mm.
It turned out that Einstein's error, or so he thought was an error, turned out to be correct. Now, here's the story. Albert Einstein...
Didn't you tell us a few weeks ago that it might not be correct?
No. That might have been something else.
Yeah,
it could have been something else. Einstein published his theory of general relativity in 1916. Now, this theory of general relativity said that, you know, the universe is either going to be expanding or contracting. It just can't sit there motionless. If it's sitting there motionless, the theory, so it would predict, would actually, because of gravitational attraction, it would start shrinking, you see. And so if it's moving outward, it would stop and it would start coming in again. And so there was no way for the universe to be static. But when astronomers looked out at the sky, it looked to them like it was static. And so Einstein said, I must propose an adjustment to my theory if it's actually static. So it meant that he'd have to tinker with his formulas. He needed a force that was a repulsive force that would counteract gravity. So he basically put in a cosmological constant, which was a new anti-gravity force, and he put that in the theory, and that predicted that, in fact, you could have a static universe. But shortly after that, Edward Hubble came along and did further observations, and he discovered that the universe was not stationary at all, in fact, that the universe was expanding, that it was moving apart. So Einstein was ecstatic, and this actually led to the Big Bang Theory, because if it was expanding, and if you just project those paths backwards, they would all go back to one point, indicating the Big Bang. Well, Einstein was ecstatic when Hubble announced these results because it meant that he didn't have to have this correction. And so he dumped the cosmological constant. It wasn't needed after all because the universe was expanding. In fact, Einstein went to Mount Wilson, where the observatory where Hubble was, you know, did his observations in 1931, just to shake Hubble's hands and to thank him for saving relativity from the cosmological constant. And Einstein denounced this constant as one of the greatest blunders of his life, but his pronouncement was premature. In the mid-1990s, two independent teams of astronomers, one based in Lawrence Berkeley National Lab and the others at observatories in Baltimore and Australia, one was in Baltimore, kind of a homeboy, they decided to find out about this expansion. And so they did. They had bigger and better telescopes than Hubble, and they decided to use supernovas as markers. Supernovas are these huge explosions in space, and they were going to track these supernovas to see how fast they were moving as they went deeper and deeper into space.
You sound like Carl Sagan, deeper and deeper. Yes,
and by measuring deeper, by millions and millions of stars. And so by measuring the speed of these supernovas as they went further and further and further out, they discovered that the expansion of the universe was not slowing down at all, but in fact that it was speeding up. And the only way that you could predict a universe that was accelerating at a faster rate instead of slowing down as it expanded was to add in Einstein's cosmological constant again. So actually, in the beginning, he was correct. So he just declared his error a little too quickly.
Uh-huh.
The 1998 discovery of the accelerating universe earned the Lawrence Berkeley Lab's Saul Perlmutter half of this year's Nobel Prize. In his competition, Brian Schmidt of the Australian National University and Adam Rees of the Space Telescope Science Institute split the other half. Now, what is this anti-gravity force anyway?
What is it?
Well, actually, theoretical physicists are trying to figure that out. Right now, they're calling it dark energy.
Have you heard that
dark energy thing?
I've heard that.
They
yes.
call it dark energy, and they're trying to use string theory, and they're trying to use all sorts of
we're going down a road.
All
we don't
sorts
need to go
of
down.
Stuff to try to. And so it's highly controversial. And the fact is, they really don't know what it is.
Uh-huh.
They haven't really settled in on it. They're still trying to figure out. That'll probably be the next Nobel Prize. But the fact is, Einstein declared his error just a little too quickly.
A little too quickly.
Yes.
My brain needs to cool down after that.
Okay.
That's pretty deep. Let's take a short break. This is Tech Talk, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. Stand by. We'll be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University.
Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Okay, all you guys are just tired of the $900, you know, iPad talk.
That'll be me. Where's David Burton?
There's a $50 tablet. Now, this $50 tablet, let me tell you what it is. It's called the UbiSlate.
I need one just because of the name.
UbiSlate. It sounds like a Star Wars.
It does.
Would you pass my UbiSlate, please? It's a 7-inch resistive touch screen. It's 800 by 480. See, resistive touch instead of capacitive touch is not as sensitive. I think most of the iPads have capacitive touch. It's resistive touch. It's a 366 megahertz processor. It's not a dual core. It's a single core. It is 256 megabytes of RAM. And of course, the iPad is 512 megabytes of RAM. It has Wi-Fi connectivity. It has 2 gigabytes of storage only. It has mobile conductivity through a dongle. In other words, it's got a USB port, and you can plug a cell phone radio that hooks into the USB, a dongle radio. I think that's a funny name.
In fact, Andrew is laughing hysterically behind you right now. He can't deal with it.
Yeah.
I'm trying, however, to be a grown-up about this.
Mobile connectivity through a dongle. It's also called like a thumb drive.
Yeah,
it's like
right.
a thumb drive.
I think you've decided to use that
but
word.
But the technical word would be dongle. It has 180.
Are you finished yet?
No, it has 180 minute battery life,
uh-huh.
and it's 1 to 2 hours of played on HD video. And it comes with DataWind's Ubi Surfer browser, the Ubi Surfer. Now here's the rub: It's only available in India.
Oh, well, there's that. So it's going to cost a little more. It'll cost about $3,050
thanks to the vision
there, buy it, and bring it back.
Of Kapil Sibal. He's the India's telecommunications minister. He has wanted actually to have a super cheap tablet for the educational use for years, and he's wanted actually one for less than $50. It's now an Android-enabled tablet computer. That's a nice thing. Android's a free operating system, so that they don't have to pay any royalties. And actually, it costs 1,500 rupees, which is only $30.
Well, is this a bargain in India dollars?
Yeah.
It is?
Yeah,
that's a
bargain.
Because we talked about the economy.
It's produced by Datawin Limited, made in India. It's called the Akash Tablet. It's aimed to transform university-level education and become a standard device among students in India. 10,000 of them are already in the hands of university students in India, and 90,000 more are arriving soon. 8 to 10 million will be shipped in the next 5 years. A retail version called the Ubi Slate will debut later this year, but it's like more expensive. It's 3,000 rupees,
wow,
which would be $60. So only the university students get the $30 one, but it'll be a retail unit for $60. I think that's going to, you know, really hurt the penetration of the Apple tablet in India. So it's kind of an interesting.
The next time you go over,
but
you're going to have to.
It's only a seven. It's a small 7-inch screen. They basically, you know, pared it down in order to make it affordable, because that's the key thing in India. They need affordable education out in the. Out in the small villages, and so education is really one of India's biggest challenges.
It's not very much of a battery life.
No, it's not. No, because it's kind of a small unit. The Large Hadron Collider has inspired an Android app. Okay, you know the Large Hadron Collider. It's at CERN in Europe. It's a particle collider. They put basically protons going in opposite directions in a big ring, and then they overlap the tracks, and these protons collide with each other and make all kinds of particles. And this will be the most powerful collider in the world. And a Large Hadron, is actually the name of the particles that they, it's the class of particles that they are, that they're moving around the ring, which protons would be like in. Like a hadron. Now they have a Large Hadron Collider application. The CERN scientists created the free Android application. It provides a live feed into what particles are being smashed, as well as a computer-generated 3D model of the particles that were created from every single angle. So you can see in real time the experiments as they're being analyzed by the scientists. The application has already been downloaded by more than 10,000 people. If you want to learn more about the science of the Large Hadron Collider, you can play with animated tutorials when you stream videos from your phone about the construction of the detector and the operation. One feature of the app is called the Hunt for the Higgs. Now, the Higgs boson is the so-called God particle, because it would help physicists explain how matter has mass. It's one of the few things that scientists hope to find out in the Large Hadron Collider, and they're looking at slides to try to see whether the Higgs particle actually exists. Now, this application is strictly available for the Google Android, and there are no plans to release it for the Apple operating system.
Oh, I guess I'll just have to lose out on that.
Because these are more open source kind of guys. It's like the university community. I think they're making a political statement. Political statement here. And, of course, now, and this week, too, by the way, Fermilabs, we used to have the biggest collider in the world, but then we gave up the ghost. We let Europe take over. And we were there, and Fermilabs was in Chicago. They're shutting Fermilabs down this week. And so we've basically handed over the mantle of high energy physics to the Europeans. And I think that's a big mistake going forward.
I think my brain needs to cool down.
Okay.
It's just been so deep here today that we're going to take our final break, and we'll come back with more Tech Talk right after this. You're listening to us on 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, and 103.5 FM HD2. This is Tech Talk, and we'll be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Demand is great for IT professionals that can gain a security clearance. According to a recent Federal Computer Week article, federal agencies and private sector businesses that support government contracts can't get enough credentialed people to keep pace with government work. Tremendous opportunities exist for mid-career and late-career workers if they are retrained, particularly if they have had previous military service. Stratford University's bachelor's degree in information technology prepares students to analyze, design, implement, administer, and secure computer networks and information systems. Master's degrees are also offered in information systems and software engineering. Day and evening classes are offered so you can continue in your current field. Call Stratford University at 800-444-0804 or visit online at stratford.edu. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Now, this week, a judge approved warrantless tracking of suspect's cell phone.
Ooh.
This is actually quite significant. It's a small case, but it could have large ramifications over privacy issues. The decision was issued by U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth of the District of Columbia and said that the Stored Communications Act does not require investigators to get a warrant based on probable cause to access suspects' location history pulled from cell phone towers. Now, the ruling is based on his interpretation of cell phone calls as wire communications. And under the statute, records involving those communications are subject to less burdensome standards requiring the showing that the contents are material to an ongoing criminal investigation. The ruling, which was unsealed on Wednesday, came as a surprise to civil liberties advocates because it disregarded a federal appeals court ruling from last year that soundly rejected the U.S. government claim that it didn't need a search warrant to track suspects using GPS system location tracking devices. I mean, this seems like, so you could track your smartphone using GPS data or from triangulation with cell phone data. Now, it seems like it's really the same data they're going after.
Mm-hmm.
So this judge said, okay, that ruling only applied to GPS positioning data, but not to cell phone triangulation. He says cell phone triangulation, it should be tied to the rules relating to wired transfer. Now, the appeals court judges previously said that the surveillance of the suspect's movement were so prolonged and extensive that it was barred by the Constitution against unreasonable searches. This was the findings in the GPS case. In this current ruling, Lamberth said that the cell site location information was significantly more limited, and therefore the Maynard decision didn't apply. I tell you, privacy lawyers really do not agree with this decision. This makes it clear that we must get a revised digital privacy law in place. So many of our laws are written before we had these cell phones. There's a huge amount of data in the cell phone, and the question is that data publicly available without a search warrant, or do you need a search warrant to get it?
Right.
And I think there's going to be many more court cases relating to this coming up in the near future. This week, record iPhone sales, as you would expect.
Yep.
AT&T and Sprint, Nextel, both said that the new iPhone helped drive record single-day sales for each carrier. Sprint said it reached its best-ever day at 10 a.m. best-ever at 10 a.m. on the day that the sales opened. And AT&T said it had its best-ever day as of 1:30 p.m. on that opening day.
Mm.
The new iPhone, despite the lack of major redesign, continues to be a tremendous draw, outstripping demand for any other cell phone. The iPhone 4S drew lines at the Apple stores, so there we go again. Verizon Wireless, meanwhile, would only say that the sales were brisk and steady with steady traffic all day. I decided to wait about a week.
I don't get this whole let's stand in line because it's out for the first day thing.
It's
a waste of time, don't you think?
I'm just not that much that into that. You know, I finally did decide to get the iPhone because it was global. I could get both GSM as well.
That's what you were waiting for.
I was waiting for that, and so it was really, you know, I was nip and tuck between the iPhone and the Android, but now that the iPhone's got the global features, I'm going to go for it.
Buy a battery charger to take with you, too. You're going to need it.
I'm going to get one of these extra batteries. You can plug these external batteries you can plug in. Some folks at work have that. They just watch the battery just drain.
Oh yeah, it's amazing.
It goes. You know, Wi-Fi, if you turn off Wi-Fi, your battery will last longer.
Yeah, mine's not on. Only when I need to get on the web does the Wi-Fi come on.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay. It doesn't stay on in the background without you knowing it?
No.
Okay. That's a good feature. Apple came out with the iMessage texting service. Now, this is kind of interesting. It actually allows you to send a text message to another iPhone owner or an iPod user or an iPad user.
This is sort of like the BlackBerry feature, right?
Yeah, and the text message shows up as far as your carrier is concerned as just an email. And when the email arrives at either the other iPhone or the iPad or the iPod, it actually converts the email into what looks like a text message.
Huh.
But the difference is that text message doesn't count as a text message in your carrier's text message
count.
Aha. So they're cutting out the carrier in this thing. Now, if you use iMessage and send it to a non-Apple device, it goes out as a text message and it costs you. So now, you see, there are already things like Google Voice that actually are avoiding making phone calls using the data. So you're seeing a transition into the use of the data features of the smartphone and away from the paid services that the carriers are trying to provide. That's the same thing that happened with landlines. So, you know, at home I've got a Verizon internet coming into the house, but then I'm using voice over IP. I'm using UMA, which is a whopping $10 a year.
Yeah, I know.
And I've got unlimited calling anywhere in the U.S., and I've got calling all over the rest of the world for like two, 3 cents a minute. So the same trend is going on here with smartphones.
Yeah.
Eventually, I think it's all just going to be the delivery of just pure data, and the services are not going to be able to be sold at retail. It's kind of a long-term trend. Well, let me see here.
Yeah, you've got about 45 seconds or so.
So
the BlackBerry trouble this week.
Black.
You could probably do that pretty quickly.
The BlackBerry trouble. I went over the BlackBerry trouble week. I forgot about that. Yeah. BlackBerry service was finally restored on Thursday, and they had a backup switching architecture did not work, and a switch broke. And what happened then, once that switch failed, it knocked out service in Europe, India, Africa, Middle East, and South America. And then when they tried to transfer that traffic to other parts of the network in Europe, it overwhelmed Europe and it became a worldwide outage.
Yikes.
So finally, this was they got it up on Thursday, but this was the worst outage in the company's 12-year history. Could come at a worst possible time for BlackBerry. Well, yep. We're almost out of time. Listen, we love your emails. techtalk@stratford.edu. Go to the Stratford website, stratford.edu.
And this show will replay tomorrow at 2 p.m.
Learn more about Stratford University Program's consumer information by visiting their website at www.stratford.edu/content_pages/view/degree-programs.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
Navy football on the air today beginning at noon. Navy versus Rutgers and Capitals hockey tonight beginning at 6 p.m. with Caps Saturday night. Sunny, breezy today. Highs in the 70s right now. 60 degrees in the nation's capital at 10 a.m.
Paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated.